Here, there. Can you unmute yourself, Juanita?
Hi, and, hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm doing good. If you could, would you open this up with this reading and would you introduce our speaker and set up the workshop for us?
Absolutely, absolutely. Glad to do that. I am Juanita, and I'm a very grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of the Anand Family Group. So hi, everybody. So this is a reading from Bill's letter regarding emotional sobriety after he had many years in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Emotional sobriety. I think that many oldsters who have put our AA booze cure to severe but stressful, successful tests, often stressful, that's my word, tests may still find they often lack emotional sobriety. Perhaps they will be the spearhead for the next major development in AA, the development of much more real maturity and balance, which is to say humility, in our relations with ourselves, with our fellows, and with God. Those adolescent urges that so many of us have for top approval, perfect security, and perfect romance, urges quite appropriate to age 17, prove to be an impossible way of life when we are at age 47 and 57. Since AA began, I've taken immense wallops in all these areas because of my failure to grow up emotionally and spiritually. My God, how painful it is to keep demanding the impossible, and how very painful to discover, finally, that all along we have had the cart before the horse. Then comes the final agony of seeing how awfully wrong we have been, but still finding ourselves unable to get off the emotional merry-go-round. How to translate a right mental conviction into a right emotional result, and so into easy, happy, and good living. Well, that's not only the neurotic's problem, it's the problem of life itself. For all of us who have got to the point of real willingness to hew to the right principles in all of our affairs, even then, as we hew away, peace and joy may still elude us. That's the place so many of us AA oldsters have come to. And it's a hell of a spot, literally. How shall our unconscious, from which so many of our fears, compulsions, and phony aspirations still stream, be brought into line with what we actually believe, know, and want? How to convince our dumb, raging, and hidden Mr. Hyde becomes our main task. I've recently come to believe that this can be achieved. I believe so because I began to see many benighted ones. Folks like you and me commencing to get results. Last autumn, depression, having no real rational cause at all, almost took me to the cleaners. I began to be scared that I was in for another long chronic spell. Considering the grief I've had with depressions, it wasn't a bright prospect. I kept asking myself, why can't the 12 steps work to release depression? By the hour, I stared at the St. Francis prayer. It is better to comfort than to be comforted. Here was the formula, all right, but why didn't it work? Suddenly, I realized what the matter was. My basic flaw had always been dependence, almost absolute dependence on people or circumstances to supply me with prestige, security, and the like. Failing to get these things according to my perfectionist dreams and specifications, I had fought for them. And when defeat came, so did my depression. I need the other page, please. Thank you. There wasn't a chance of making the outgoing love of St. Francis a workable and joyous way of life until these fatal and almost absolute dependencies were cut away. Because I had, over the years, undergone a little spiritual development, the absolute quality of these frightful dependencies had never before been so starkly revealed. Reinforced by what grace I could secure in prayer, I found I had to exert every ounce of will and action to cut off these faulty emotional dependencies upon people, upon AA, indeed upon any act of circumstance whatsoever. Then only could I be free to love as St. Francis did. Emotional and instinctual satisfactions, I saw, were really the extra dividends of having love, offering love, and expressing love appropriate to each relation of life. Plainly, I could not avail myself to God's love until I was able to offer it back to him by loving others as he would have me. And I couldn't possibly do that so long as I was victimized by false dependencies. For my dependence meant demand, a demand for the possession and control of the people and the conditions surrounding me. While those words, absolute dependence, may look like a gimmick, They were the ones that helped to trigger my release into my present degree of stability and quietness of mind, qualities which I am now trying to consolidate by offering love to others regardless of the return to me. This seems to be the primary healing circuit, an outpouring love of God's creation and his people, by means of which we avail ourselves of his love for us. It is most clear that the real current can't flow until our paralyzing dependencies are broken, and broken at depth. Only then can we possibly have a glimmer of what adult love really is. If we examine every disturbance we have, great or small, we will find at the root of it some unhealthy dependence and its consequent demand. Let us, with God's help, continually surrender these hobbling demands. Then we can be set free to live and love. We may then be able to gain emotional sobriety. Of course, I haven't offered you a really new idea, only a gimmick that has started to unhook several of my own hexes at depth. Nowadays, my brain no longer races compulsively. In neither elation, grandiosity, or depression, I have been given a quiet place in bright sunshine. Bill Wilson. Thank you, Yvonne. I was sure touched by that as I read it. The woman that I'm going to introduce is not just a dear friend. She is a family member. She has been in my life for over 30 years, and I'm really glad that she's doing this on emotional sobriety, because she has been a woman that I've looked to for many years, and unfortunately not used as much as I could have, until I became absolutely desperate. And then I, because of the gift of desperation, I became teachable and relied on her to an incredible degree. And she has changed my life. She has changed the life of my family. And I wouldn't be the woman I am today if it was not for her. And she continues to be a woman I look to and respect and appreciate her emotional sobriety. So would you please, without further ado, welcome my dear, not only friend, but family member, Mary Thayer. Love you, MT.
Well, hi there. My name is Mary Thayer. I am an alcoholic. I should say, you know, I always feel that there are so many fellowships, but there are only 12 steps. And there's different ways of looking at the 12 steps. And I was privileged enough to kind of start Al-Anon when I was early on in recovery. And my first Al-Anon speaker was Elsa Chamberlain. It was like, wow. How do you get that lucky? My first AA speaker was a woman by the name of Sybil, who was the first woman alcoholic west of the Mississippi, I guess. So I feel as though I was really blessed to sit at the feet of a lot of heroes, just a lot of heroes in my process of recovery. Thanks, Juana, for your introduction. We've had a fantastic relationship over the last 30 something years. I also quote, similar to what you know I quote, is Mother Teresa's thoughts on that the problem with us today is that we draw our family circle too small. And this really is a family. And now with this Zoom thing, it's like, it's amazing to me where we're going and the opportunity we have to spread a message, I think, of depth and weight. So I'm asked to do something for 4 hours. I got laughing afterwards. I said, what did I ever say I'd do that for? Who's ever done Zoom 4 hour things? I mean, this is, you know, this is one of those things where when I was new, they used to say, God is spelled R-I-S-K, and this is a risk. This is going to be a risk. I have no idea where I'm going with it. I want to let you know that that I've been in recovery since September 13th, 1973. So I've been doing this for about 47 years. And I feel as though my path dropped me into Southern California on a geographical cure. And after 5 years of drinking, I was 12-stepped into the halls there in Southern California, where the greats were. I feel as though there were great, great people then. We didn't have cell phones. We did a lot of one-on-one stuff. We did a lot of 12-stepping. It was definitely something that brought the spirit of love into the halls. And probably love before I knew what the heck I was doing here. And many years of finding out what these 12 steps are all about. So one of the things I've done since I was about 20, I don't know, I have a friend here that I've known. She's my best friend. Her name is Missy. She's on this thing someplace. And she and I have been friends since we were 6 years old. Family friends. I'd stay with them if my folks were away and everything else. And anyway, long story short, I got sober. And then 6 years later, she got sober. And I've been sponsoring the last 46 years. So it's not too much that she and I do not know about each other. And so she and I, I was asked to do one of these things, just like you did, Yvonne. You said, well, you do this, okay, all right. The only thing I know is the big book, so that's all I'm going to share. And finally, I looked at Miss, and I said, Missy, why don't you go do this thing with me? What are you going to do? I said, I don't know, it's a retreat, and it's 3 days. Why don't you do it with me? And that started probably close to 25 years ago. And she and I have just kind of queued off each other for 25 years of doing the steps and bringing people through the 12 steps, maybe two or three times a year. I can't tell you that my rebellion to not do that is funny, because it was one of the biggest assets in my recovery. And I think it leads to this emotional sobriety that was just spoken about. Because we named these retreats after a quote on page 19 in our big book that says, elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. And a better demonstration of these principles are in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. So homes is first. I didn't like hearing that. I didn't like that because I had made I was a single parent. I was a very bad parent. And to talk about spiritual principles in my home was not, I mean, I'd like to definitely act right in my occupation and my different affairs or acquaintances or whatever, but at home was a kicker for me. But if I hadn't been doing the program over and over again, I'm of the school of doing the 12 steps, 1 through 12, 1 through 12, 1 through 12, 1 through 12. I believe that they are spiritual tools, as it's described. It's a set of spiritual tools that they're not weapons, although for a long time I thought the fourth step was a weapon. I didn't think it was really a spiritual tool. But as years have gone on and us doing, Missy and I facilitating these, I have finally found that they are the answer to help me to get an understanding on why I am unable to have some emotional sobriety in areas of my life, different areas of my life. And we found a technique in these workshops, and that's what I'm going to do today. I don't know what else to do, so I'm just going to kind of share on that. I'm going to give you some examples on how that came about and what happened. So there was a quote I saw when I was brand new in recovery. I remember sitting at it was on the back of some You know, in the old days, you used to go to a coffee shop, you sat at like a bar, you know, and there'd be sayings, and I'd get a cup of coffee, and I would be sitting there, and there was this one shop I went to, and they had this sign on the back of the wall, and I kept reading it over and over again, and I kept saying to myself, God, that's just what I do. I wish I wouldn't do that. I wish I could do the opposite of that. And I, you know, I just kept kind of looking at it and looking at it. So finally, I wrote it down, and then I transferred it to the beginning of my big book. My first big book has it written on the cover, inside cover. And it says, after everything is said and done, more is said than done. And I realized that was a story of my life. After everything was said and done, more was said than done. I would talk to you about all the things that were going on, and I wouldn't do anything. I'd just maybe order another drink. And then I'd talk to you about all the things that are going wrong. And but now I had carried that over into recovery. And I finally saw that I needed to, this was a program where we share our experience, strength, and hope, not my opinions. And so I really don't have too much to share with you, or what I share with you, I've done. I don't share too many opinions. If I do, to be honest with you, I'll tell you, this is my opinion. I've never gone through this, but maybe this could work. I don't, no idea. But I don't think in this, I don't think we're in therapy. I think we have spiritual tools in order to get a solution spiritually. And as my book is true, it says that the main purpose is to find a God of my understanding that will help me solve my problem. And that means we're going to talk about things that are spiritual as well as moral. And if alcohol, once the alcohol is removed, the main problem centers in my mind. So the only solution is not with my mind. It's going to be a spiritual solution. I have to get a God that does business with me and I could do business with. Now, I am not of a religious background, except for money, property, and prestige. That's a religion that I was raised with. But I really did not have God presented to me to be a helper or non-helper. It was kind of a neutral thing. I had some unlearning to do in order to find out what God meant for me in this program. I'm going to start this thing by telling you that my first 20 years of the program, I did it mentally. I did it with the idea of getting all the knowledge I could on what the black lines in the big book said, because they said it was a basic text. And I felt if I only knew this, then maybe I didn't have to die of this disease. And there was nothing wrong with that. I'm so grateful that I did that. But it doesn't claim intellectual enlightenment here. It only claims spiritual progress. And with spiritual progress, I believe that we can reach a place where we can not revert back to type all the time if something doesn't go our way, that we can gain some type of emotional sobriety. So in doing this workshop, I just thought I'd look at this up. Before I start, though, I want to start this whole thing, and usually I start every session with it. It's called a set-aside prayer, and I'm just going to basically tell you what it says here, and hopefully get quiet for a moment. God, please help me to set aside everything I know and everything I think I know about myself, the 12 steps, this workshop, and you, God, so that I may have an open heart, an open mind, a new experience, and please let me see the truth. Thank you. So a dictionary thing on emotional sobriety says it can be described as the ability to deal with feelings positively. The individual who is emotionally sober might not always be walking around bursting with joy, but they will no longer be such a victim of their emotions. This type of sobriety can be defined as the ability of to feel their feelings. When I first got into recovery and I found my sponsor, she asked me to describe what had happened to me. And when I got finished telling her, she said to me, "You told me that in the third person, not the first." And I didn't know what she was talking about. And she said, "One day you'll share your tears. One day you will feel what has happened." And that took quite a while because I did something that I like to put this up when I'm doing workshops with Missy. It's a Chinese proverb. And this is kind of what I did all my life. Suppression leads to momentary relief and permanent pain. Feeling my experience leads to momentary pain and permanent relief. And that is probably the reason why I haven't been able to, as the years have gone on, which kept me from being authentic with anybody, is that I repressed my feelings. I never let you know who I was or what was going on. And the 12 steps will help me get through some of this stuff to see what's blocking me. And how do I want to do this? The broad topic, emotional sobriety. And so what we do in our workshops, and I have two other gals here that I might call on to help me because I've done the workshops with them too, and that's Heather P. and also Dawn L. And so if I call on them, it's just that I'm in a blockage and they'll pick up and do something. Won't you, girls? Thanks. Yeah. So when we start these workshops, we kind of talk about the first step, but it's the only thing I can do, is that where is my life unmanageable? Where do I feel powerless? What's happening to me? And sometimes when I have these workshops, a lot of the ladies that are there have been had long-term recovery, and they don't know what they're going to work on, but it's an experiential workshop. I don't do all the talking. My God, that'd be awful. So you have to do some work, okay? So I want you to think about that. Where are you? Where would you say that your life is unmanageable and that you're powerless? How do you find that out? I usually talk about it as when I get this feeling that it's kind of like I have a thought in my mind, it's like a gerbil in a cage, and it's just going round and round and round. And if you call me up, I'll tell you about that problem. And then I'll hang up. And then if Juana calls me, I'll tell her about that problem. And it's just going to go around. And then if I call my sponsor, Missy, I'm going to tell her about that problem. And continue to tell her about that problem. But she, unfortunately, I've sponsored her, but we co-sponsor each other. And somehow she's listened along the way. And my original sponsor would say to me, "Mary Thea, when we were drinking, we talked about our problem. And then we talked about our problem. And then we took a drink and then we talked about our problem." And she said, "In recovery, we talk about our problem. And then we talk about the solution." And that's how I was introduced very easily into what is the solution. And so it doesn't mean that I'm not able to call her with any situation that's going on with me. And throughout the years, I know the areas of my life that can trigger other than an emotional response. I'm finding new ones, which is interesting. What happens is that we will talk about it. And then I have something called first step questions. I get to a point, I don't have these screenshot things, I'm sorry, but I can read them to you. And if you ask me or you need them, I will take something and send it to you, Yvonne. I'm sorry, I'm kind of a novice at this. But
we'll catch it and put it in the chat. No worries.
I can
watch it and we will put it in the chat if we can.
Okay. All right. The first step questions I deal with to find out where my life is unmanageable is, Missy might say to me, can you let go of trying to figure out that?
Goes in and out right here.
Not too good with this tech stuff. Anyway, can you hear me now? Okay. So Missy might say to me, you know, if I bring this up enough, in some way or other, she'll form it to me to say, could I let go of wanting to figure this out? She'll say, can you let go of trying to figure out this problem? And then she might say, can you let go of wanting to know what to do? Can I let go of wanting to know anything for this moment right now? Can I just let go for a moment, take a breath? Can I let go? Can I let go of wanting to think? My God, have you ever listened to somebody on and on and on? I mean, I do a lot of fifth steps. The end of them, sometimes I'm so tired. I go, my God, I'm exhausted. How are you doing with all of this? But I'm exhausted with how much pain and just thinking, oh my God. Can I let go of disapproving of myself right now? Now those are the questions that once I finally say, yeah, I can't figure this out. Once I finally say that, I'm ready for the second step. Until then, not consciously, but unconsciously, I'm going to try to play, and I have an ace in the hole. In case this doesn't work, I'll try this. I'll manipulate here. I'll be a martyr. I'll be something. I will try to figure something out to make it go my way. But when I'm done and all the aces in the hole actually aren't working, and I say, I can't figure this out. Really, the gift is when you really pick up the telephone and call someone, you have said that. Do you know that? You have actually gone, I can't figure this out. I got to talk to somebody. And at that moment, there's a surrender. There's a principle about being honest with yourself and somewhat surrendered. And that's necessary for us to go forward with any aspect of our life that is blocking the feeling of the presence of God. I realized one time when I did this, that I was really, really a wreck. And I live behind me. If I opened these drapes, you'd see Tampa Bay. The sun's going down, so I can't do it, or you won't see me. Maybe you'd like to see that rather than me. I don't know. But anyway, one time I was having a couple of years ago, I was really in dire straits with a situation that was going on. And I remember walking up to the window, putting my head down on the windowsill and saying, God, I can't figure this out. I just can't figure it out. And as I lifted up my head and looked, four dolphins went by. At that moment, it was almost as if there was a presence that said, hey, we got this. We got it. You can let it go. It's okay. Now, I don't know how many people have ever heard me talk about this before, but after 20 years of doing this program, I had a situation where I realized I was in a lot of fear. And I was in fear most of the time. I wasn't even aware of that feeling. I'd suppressed so many things. But that didn't mean that things weren't going along or whatever. But I was fearful. In fact, if I had to be totally honest, it was more fearful because I'd had 20 years of knowing what the black line said, and I was doing the deal and I was managing right and all this stuff. And yet I had this fear. And it concerned me. It really did. For whatever reason, I was reading our big book and I came into Bill's story and he talks about it. You know, you're getting old and you're forgetting the pages, Mary Thayer. I think it's page 13 or 9 or something. Let's look and see. Oh, my God, I did it right the first time. Page 13. And it said that, it says, I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend take them away, root and branch. And I remember stopping at that moment, and I started to ponder that line. And I thought to myself, my God, God, do I think of you as a friend? And to be honest with you, I had never had that, I'd never brought that into my mind. And so I started to look at that newfound friend. Now, I had created a God of reason, rationale, and logic in my first 20 years of recovery. If I do this, this happens. If I do this, I'm safe. If I do that, I'm safe. I realized that I did not have so much an experiential God, not that I didn't get God's apps and things like that, but I really had not brought into the context of a God being a best friend. And when I pondered that, I thought about Missy, and I thought to myself, I have a best friend. And I know that, Missy, you're not even at your desk and I'm talking to you. Anyway, see, she disappears, but my real friend doesn't have to disappear, even though she does. But if I see her, and if I walk into a room with her, immediately I feel safe. Immediately I realize that I've told her everything. There isn't anything we don't have between us. We know each other that well. I can tell her about my fears. I can tell her anything. And there's an energy that happens that I just feel safe and connected when I see her. I'm very blessed. Not too many people have friends for 70 years. Anyway, I started to think about the fact that if I came to believe in a power greater than myself to restore me to sanity, what did that mean? Sanity meant sound thinking and balance. And usually if I finally get through my first step, I realize whatever my reaction has been in regard to whatever problem that I decide I don't want to figure it out anymore, is usually I don't have any sound thinking and balance. So I had to come to believe in a God that was a friend, that would hear me and not judge me. Somehow, I don't know, I had a lot of friends that had gods that judged them. And I just I guess I just thought that that was what happens if you do something bad. And so I liked the idea of that. And so that helped me to get to a point where I could actually make a decision to turn my will and my lives over to a God of my experience. And the experience was a feeling. It wasn't necessarily a mental conclusion. So that's about the only thing. It took me 20 years to figure that out. If that's the only thing you get on this workshop for 4 hours, is make sure that you've got a God that you feel safe with, that you feel the feeling of being safe and connected. It could be, it comes from me off of this bay behind me. It comes from me. I had a kitty named E.T. I now have two kitties. Their energy and their presence makes me feel loved. If you have any animal, maybe you have that also. I remember when my child was young, just watching her sleep would touch my heart. And there was just an energy. In the summers, and I lived in Santa Fe, and thought that's where I'd always live until I got so sick with lung issues that I had to come to sea level. But the mountains and the beauty of Santa Fe is enchanting. It is the land of enchantment. And the energy there, I just felt safe and protected in. If you have to live in Florida and there's no hurricane, I love where I live. Let me tell you, I really do. It's magical. And those that have to endure being on Facebook with me have to endure seeing the sunsets every night. And what that does for me is that for that moment, there's no problem. I don't have any problem. I have a feeling of just being present with the presence. And that's an energy that has grown, and it would not have grown if I didn't know how to do these steps the way I'm going to explain them today. So I have just want to talk about something about safety. There's a lot of us that I think we come in and we're not feeling safe. And there's when we first come into these halls and we're not feeling safe, there's an energy that we feel from fellow members. I'm sure you wouldn't be here if you hadn't felt that welcoming energy. That is also a God as he expresses himself in our group conscience. Now, what happened for me about, I don't know, was it 6 or 7 years ago? Heather, I'm going to call on you, so you better have what I want you to read. It's something you wrote. I sponsor this gal, Heather, and she follows me around a lot. In fact, she bought my home in Santa Fe, for God's sakes. So I have a place to go when I want to go back. But we've even brought this to the Faroe Islands, which I haven't even known where the Faroe Islands were. They're in the northern Atlantic between Denmark and Iceland. And we brought the big book and the 12-step meeting over there. But she follows me around. She's around quite a bit. And she's a writer and an artist and interesting gal. Knew it when I saw her. Knew there was a problem there. Anyway. But I would talk to her about, I think safety's a lie. I got this feeling that safety's a lie. How I perceive safety, I think, is a lie. And so after she followed me around, she wrote this. Heather, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Have you got that?
I do.
Ah.
I'm a little psychic, I knew.
You knew psychically I was going to ask you to do that?
Yes. Good.
I want you to introduce you to Heather. She's in Santa Fe.
Hi, I'm Heather. I'm an alcoholic. Do you want me to just read it?
Please. You can talk about it if you have something you want to say about it.
No, I'll just read it. So this was written, this was written 5 years ago. I feel like it's still valid today. So safety is a lie. I grew up in a silent house of want, a slow, consistent simmer of need that choked back words, made hope unapproachable, back-filled dreams that dared to rise up. There was a tension that suspended us all, a tautness of speech, a thin line of love that could be easily snapped with one misstep or poorly laid action. Be happy with what you get. Never ask for more. Never let go of what you get. Hoard what you can, for the day will come when there is no more. You deserve no more. So I learned to sneak and steal and hide and defend. I learned to be you and him and them. A properly placed, practiced smile that brought you near but not close. I became no one to everyone and survived behind a two-way mirror, always watching without threat of being spotted. An internal cave dweller, moving through the darkness by touch. I handcrafted a delusion of distance to keep me safely away from you, so you could not hurt me or abandon me, so you could not see me. And this is the ultimate lie I tell myself, that separation is safety, that I can create an atmosphere of safety in the world of myself lying under the radar of God, never treading in your water. As I am growing into my own skin, I am coming to understand that I need you. I need the mirror of your soul to discover my own. I need the mirror of your fear to settle in the heart of my eye so I can see where I have disallowed God to walk with me. I need to be open to the hurt of life so divine healing can begin. Self-produced safety is a lie designed by fear, not of the dark, but of the divine light that glimmers within.
Thanks, hon. You were a little, how did everybody hear her? Could you hear it? You could? Yeah, good. I'm glad. Heather, if you do a screenshot and send that to me, I'll send it to Yvonne. Okay?
Okay. I can put the link up in the chat if that's all
right. Oh, you can? Oh, good. Okay. Do that then, if you would. Thanks.
Okay.
All right. The reason I had you hear that is that sometimes some of our traits that we use are to protect us, and they were necessary when she was a young child in that home, but they aren't necessarily necessary today. And as you continue to do the steps over and over again, some of these layers will start to move, because each step is designed for you to get closer to that loving friend, pal energy, so that you do not have to be frightened at that level. How do we start these workshops, Miss? I think we'll go to page 52. So Miss and I talk about these, the bedevilments, and this is another way you can decide what you want to work on. Just take one thing, okay? Do you want to do the bedevilments, Missy? You want me to do them?
Well, let me say hi to everybody. My name's okay. Missy. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm happy to be here. I disappeared off Zoom a few minutes ago. We're about to have a very big thunderstorm with lots of lightning and lots of wind and hail. So I'm kind of watching. Why don't you start, because the clouds are rolling in and I may have to interrupt myself. So.
All right. Very
good. Are you guys talking about the big book, just to be clear?
Yes. Page 52 in the big book is what we call the bedevilments. And again, I have them here, but I'm sure you can't see them all. But anyways, what we do is we take the bedevilments and we turn them into a question. There's eight of them. And you ask this of yourself today in your recovery, where you are right now. Okay. This is not about 47 years ago. This is about where I am today for my emotional maturity, if you will. Am I having trouble with personal relationships? I ask myself, can I control my emotional nature? Number three, am I a prey to misery and depression? Four, can I make a living? Five, do I have a feeling of uselessness? Six, am I full of fear? Seven, am I unhappy? Eight, am I able to be of real help to other people? Now, I ran across these, and I remember the second time I went through them. I was doing all right. I had a number of years, and for some reason, I heard that talked about, and I thought, no, I don't seem to have any problems right now with personal relationships. I can control my emotional nature. And I kind of went through them and I kind of thought, no, I'm doing okay. I really am. And then this very wise man, he's now passed. His name was Clint H. out of California. He talked about this and he said, for those of you who are doing well, I want you to ask the question this way. Do you believe that your God has brought you as far as he can in regard to personal relationships? And immediately I went, God, I hope not. And it would be like this person that I thought maybe I'd like to have a better relationship with. Has God brought me as far as he can in regard to emotional nature? Today I can say, God, I hope he hasn't, especially with one situation I've been dealing with. I hope there's further emotional balance that I can get. Has he brought me in as far as he can in regard to misery and depression? God, I hope not. I hope he's going to give me more in regard to the pandemic. Has he brought me as far as he can in making a living? I hope not. I hope not. Living can have a lot of meanings. Has he brought me as far as he can in regard to feelings of uselessness? Has he brought me far as he can in regard to fear, as in regard to being unhappy, and being of real help to other people? Now, when that was posed to me, I thought to myself, each time I said, God, I hope you haven't, I hope you haven't, I hope you haven't. That triggered something in me, because a minute ago, I just told you I was doing all right, didn't I? I gave you a hint on what kind of a mind and what kind of a God I was dealing with. One with reason, rationale, and logic. Because compared to the way I was 46 years ago, I'm doing really great, folks. I really am. I really am. The way I was doing 20 years ago, even I was doing, I'm doing okay. And what I was doing when originally reading those was comparing myself to years ago, not to where I am today, not to what was currently happening. Because you see, I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, and self-pity. And my delusion is that I'm done, that I've really got it made. I got a lot of years in this program. The truth is, I'm a seasoned beginner. Let me tell you, I don't know how many people have more time than I do. And if you're here, please tell me if you've arrived someplace. I haven't. I have not arrived. All I know is that I have a daily reprieve. So when Missy and I pose this, as I'm posing it to all of you participants here, is there like a little gray area that went by when I said, has God brought you as far as he can in regard to personal relationships? Have you got a relationship you might want to have a little bit more clarity or balance with? You don't have to tell me. This isn't going to be you get up here and talk to me. This is going to be you can use what you want. It's only Missy, myself, and Heather that are and Dawn that are going to expose ourselves here. None of you people have to, so that's the gift, all right? So don't get worried here. Hopefully you have a piece of paper and a pencil, and one day you sit down and just see that these, you know, it works, it really does, these steps, they're fascinating. So once you get that, there was another thing that he brought out, meaning Clint, that let's just ask yourself this. What are the things in my life that I am not willing to give up for a better relationship with God? Have something to do with your image? Giving up a relationship, giving up money, giving up food, drink, cigarettes, gambling? Is there something in your life that you're not willing to give up for a better relationship with your best friend, your new pal? What is it? Just doesn't say if you admit it that you have to change. It just said, just admit it. That's the first step, to admit it. Yeah, I'm not ready. For years, I was not ready to give up my daughter. Let me tell you, I'm ready. Anyway, and she's ready to have me give her up. It works both ways. But that took a lot for me to understand at a spiritual level.